Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
A new study has found that babies have a higher chance of dying in their first few weeks of life if their mothers live close to an oil spill. Researchers studied information about babies dying and oil spills in the Niger Delta area of southern Nigeria. The researchers described their results as shocking. The study comes from scientists from the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. They found that babies born in the Niger Delta were 2 times as likely to die in the first month of life if their mothers lived close to an oil spill before they became pregnant. Nigeria is one of the largest oil producers in Africa, and oil spills are common there. An estimated 240,000 barrels of unprocessed or crude petroleum oil are spilled into the Niger Delta every year. The environmental effects are clear to see. Waterways covered with black liquid, animals that cannot breathe, and dying trees and plants along the coast. Now the effects on human health are becoming evident. The researchers compared information on 6,600 recent oil spills with results from Nigeria's 2013 Demographic and Health Survey. The study showed that even spills taking place 5 years before the women became pregnant doubled the chances of their babies dying after birth. However, spills that happened during pregnancy appeared to have little effect. Unborn and newborn babies are thought to be at a greater risk as their bodies have yet to build up natural defenses. But the researchers say more studies are needed to show how crude oil affects health. Crude oil is a mix of complex hydrocarbons, substances found in oil, coal, and gas. Some are harmful to human health, so a second line of research would be to examine what parts of crude oil are the most harmful for both adults and newborns. The new study suggests that the effects of oil spills will continue for many years after they happen. In 2015, oil company Royal Dutch Shell agreed to share the costs of cleaning up its oil spills in the Niger Delta. The United Nations says the cleanup work will likely take 30 years. Critics say the company has paid just a very small amount of the money it promised for the effort. Shell blames oil thieves for causing many of the spills. The Nigerian government is the majority owner of the Shell Petroleum Development Company, which directs most of Royal Dutch Shell's operations in Nigeria. I'm Alice Bryant.
A Leonardo da Vinci painting of Jesus Christ that recently sold for a record $450 million is heading to the Louvre, Abu Dhabi. The 500-year-old painting is called Salvator Mundi, Latin for Savior of the World. It is one of fewer than 20 Da Vinci paintings known to exist. The Louvre Abu Dhabi opened on November 11th. The Waterfront Museum in the United Arab Emirates capital city includes Middle Eastern objects and paintings, as well as works by Western artists. Last month, Christie's Auction House in New York City sold the painting for the most money ever paid for a piece of art at auction. The auction house did not say who the buyer was, but the New York Times newspaper has reported that the buyer may have been a Saudi prince. The 66-centimeter tall painting dates to around 1500. It shows Jesus dressed in Renaissance-style clothing. His right hand is raised in blessing, and his left hand is holding a crystal ball. The painting was in a private collection of King Charles I of England. It disappeared from view until 1900, when a British collector bought it. In 2005, a group of art dealers paid less than $10,000 for the artwork. It was badly damaged and partly painted over. They restored the work and proved that the painting was done by Leonardo da Vinci himself. And that's what's trending today. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
The American television series Seinfeld was famous for its unusual and often strange conversations. These conversations often took place in a diner, a kind of small, informal restaurant. In one program, the character George is sad about where he is in life. George feels that he has made poor choices. He wants to change his life around by doing the opposite of what he has done. He would like to eat different foods, be willing to talk to strangers, and so on. Let's listen to a few lines from the show.
Well, here's your chance to try the opposite. Instead of tuna salad and being intimidated by women, chicken salad and going right up to them.
Yeah, I should do the opposite. I should.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Today, we will explore the idea of opposites. Namely, we will look at words that have at least two meanings, one meaning and an opposite meaning. We will also explore disputes around these words, like one involving the word literally.
English has a number of words with opposite meanings. They are called contronyms. You will hear contronyms in the news, official speeches, and everyday conversation. You will even see them in writing. Consider the word sanction. A sanction can be a kind of punishment for disobeying a law, especially an international law. Imagine you hear a news story about the United Nations Security Council. The story might begin with the words, "Security Council votes to impose sanctions." If you follow the news, you are probably familiar with this expression. However, the word sanction can have an opposite meaning, an official approval for an action. For example, you might read a news story about a legal dispute. The story might say, critics say the policy lacked legal sanction. In this case, the critics are saying that the policy did not have official approval. Because sanction has a second, opposite meaning, it is a contronym. Here's another example of a contronym, the word bill. You can have a $50 bill, or you can receive a $50 bill for medical services. In the first example, bill means a piece of paper money. In the second case, bill suggests a document that tells you how much money you owe.
Americans sometimes dispute the use of a contronym. Consider the word literally. On the internet, many stories and videos are sharply critical of this word.
A lot of you out there who say literally don't seem to understand what literally means.
Literally, in its traditional meaning, means by the letter. It later took on the meaning with the meaning of each word given exactly. Americans often use it in a completely different way. Imagine you hear the following conversation.
Did you hear Tom's story?
Yes, I was literally dying of laughter. It was so funny.
Here, the second speaker does not mean that she is dying. When she says literally, she means figuratively. The word literally is like the character George from Seinfeld. Literally, like George, spent time doing one thing. Now, it is looking for a change. Naturally, the word itself is not making this decision to change. English speakers are using the word in different ways. There is nothing new or strange about this change. Many words change over time, just like people and societies.
John McWhorter is an expert on languages. He notes that English speakers use some words for what he calls common social uses. He refers to these uses by the acronym FACE. Do not worry about all of the terms. The one we are interested in is the letter F in FACE. It means factuality. McWhorter notes that English speakers use words to show how truthful or exact their statements are. In other words, they include words to show how factual their statements are. Literally has become a word that shows factuality. It shows that the speaker is using an overstatement or exaggerated language. So when a person says, "I was literally dying of laughter," they are using the word literally to show that they are using exaggerated language. If you compare this use of literally with the first definition of literally, you will notice that literally has become a contronym. McWhorter notes that this is a natural progression for the word. There is nothing wrong or incorrect about this change, he adds.
The next time you are listening to an English speaker or reading a document in English, look for examples of contronyms. If you are having trouble understanding a sentence, it might be because the speaker or writer is using a less common meaning of a word. Try to think about the word's context. Sometimes you can understand a contronym's meaning by thinking about the other words that come in the sentence with it. Contronyms are a strange, fun part of language. They are literally the easiest thing about the English language.
I think you are exaggerating. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document had established a loose union of the 13 states with a weak central government. But instead of amending the Articles, the delegates at the convention wrote a completely new constitution. As we heard last time, one of the issues they discussed was slavery. The existence of slavery affected decisions like how to count the national population. It also affected the powers proposed for Congress. The delegates at the convention accepted several political compromises on the issue of slavery. One compromise was the three-fifths rule. The population would be counted every 10 years to decide how many members each state would have in the House of Representatives in Congress. With the three-fifths rule, the delegates agreed that every five slaves would be counted as three people. Another compromise would allow states to import slaves until the year 1808. After that, no new slaves would be brought into the country. Many of the delegates in Philadelphia did not like these compromises, but they knew the compromises would keep the southern states, where slavery was most widespread, from leaving the convention. After all the debates, bitter arguments, and compromises, the delegates were nearing the end of their work. 4 months had passed since the convention began. The weather had been hot. Emotions had been hot, too, but that was expected. After all, the men in Philadelphia, and the delegates were all men, were deciding the future of their country. Early in September, the convention appointed five delegates to a committee of style. It was their job to write the document containing all the decisions made at the convention. The chairman of the committee was William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut. The other members were Alexander Hamilton of New York, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, Rufus King of Massachusetts, and James Madison of Virginia. Of these five men, Governor Morris was known for the beauty of his language. So Johnson asked him to write the Constitution. Here in Washington, visitors to the National Archives can read an original copy of the United States Constitution. Leanne Potter at the National Archives says visitors are often surprised that the document is only 4 pages long.
The irony is that the pages are actually nearly 3 feet long and about 2 feet wide. They're written on parchment. In other words, they're written on animal skin using an iron gall ink. And this particular document was created in September of 1787.
The convention approved 23 articles for the Constitution. Governor Morris rewrote them in simpler form, so there were just 7.
The document itself is divided by article, and each article focuses on a different aspect of the American government.
Article 1 describes the powers of the Congress. It explains how to count the population for purposes of representation. and it states who can become senators or representatives and how long they can serve. Article 2 describes the powers of the president. It explains the requirements for the office and how the president is to be elected. Article 3 describes the powers of the federal judiciary, which includes the Supreme Court and all of the district and circuit courts. Leanne Potter at the National Archives explains.
That part of our government makes sure that the laws that the legislative branch creates and are being enforced by the executive branch are in fact constitutional. In other words, that the laws they create are legal themselves.
The first three articles provide a system of checks and balances. The purpose is to prevent any of the three branches of government, legislative, executive, or judicial, from becoming too powerful. Article 4 explains the rights and duties of the states under the new central government. Article 5 provides a system for amending the Constitution. Article 6 declares the Constitution to be the highest law of the land. And Article 7 simply says the Constitution will be established when 9 states approve it. The members of the convention wrote a preamble for the Constitution. It began, "We, the undersigned delegates of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and so on," it listed all 13 states by name. The Committee of Style did not think it was a good idea to list each state. After all, Rhode Island never sent a delegate to Philadelphia. And no one knew for sure if every state would approve the Constitution. So Governor Morris wrote instead, "We, the people of the United States of America." Those simple words solved the problem. But they caused angry debate during the fight to approve the Constitution. They made clear that the power of the central government came not from the states, but directly from the citizens of the nation. Modern-day Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas came from a family descended from slaves. He grew up in the southern state of Georgia. Justice Thomas recalled having to memorize the opening statement to the Constitution when he was a child.
I just think it's so fascinating to think of these black kids in the segregated school in Savannah reciting the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. What do we believe? I mean, everything's so obviously in front of you is wrong. You can't go to the public library. You can't live in certain neighborhoods. You can't go to certain schools. But despite all of that, you lived in an environment of people who said it was still our birthright to be included.
The rest of the preamble states why the Constitution was written. In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The next step was to sign the document. On September 17th, the delegates gathered for the last time. One might think all of their business finally was done. But Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts rose to speak. If it was not too late, he said, he would like to make a change. Instead of electing one representative for every 40,000 people, as agreed, he suggested changing the number to 30,000. Gorham's proposal could have caused a bitter argument. Then, suddenly, George Washington, the president of the convention, stood up. The delegates were surprised. He had said little all summer. Now George Washington rose to express his support for the proposed change. He said it would guarantee a greater voice in the government for the people of the nation. Every delegate agreed to the change, which would mean a larger number of representatives in Congress. Finally, it was time to sign the Constitution. It was also the last chance to speak against it. Many delegates stated their objections to different parts of the document. In the end, most of the delegates declared that for the good of the nation, they would sign it. Several, however, refused to put their name on the Constitution. Edmund Randolph of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts said they could not sign the document. They believed it would not be approved by the states. And that, Gerry said, would lead to civil war. George Mason of Virginia also refused to sign. He had several reasons, but his first objection was that the document did not guarantee enough liberties. There is no declaration of any kind for preserving the liberty of the press, or the trial by jury in civil causes, nor against the danger of standing armies in time of peace. Mason wanted to add a declaration of rights. Randolph, Gerry, and Mason were the only delegates present in Philadelphia who did not sign the Constitution. Four other delegates who opposed it went home before the signing. So did nine delegates who supported the Constitution but went home early. Few of the delegates in Philadelphia could feel sure that enough states would approve the Constitution to make it the law of the land. As several of them said later, they wrote it the best they could. Without it, the young nation would break apart before it even had a chance to succeed. If future generations did not like the Constitution, it offered ways for them to change it. Here is George Washington, played by an actor.
I'm a practical man. I hope for the best, but I plan for the worst. And that's what this document does.
A record of the convention said that as the last delegates were signing the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin looked toward the president's chair. There was a sun painted on the back of the chair at the top. Franklin observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to make a rising sun look different from a setting sun. Franklin said he had looked often at the sun on the chair during the convention without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, he said, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.